This is the time set for oral argument in Padilla versus Hunt, case number 72191. Mr. Eisenberg, are you ready? Please approach and let us know how much time you wish to reserve for rebuttal.
Attempt to reserve 5 minutes.
Good luck.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing for the appellant. There's an appeal and a cross appeal. On the appeal, the issue is relatively straightforward. If a defendant's liability insurance company pays a bill for the plaintiff, is that payment considered a collateral source payment within the collateral source rule? Every court that has addressed this issue, every state and federal court at every level, has concluded that the tortfeasor's liability insurance company is not a collateral source within the collateral source rule. The confusion here was a result of the original decision in Nevada was the Proctor decision, 1996. Then there was Bass-Davis about 10 years later. Bass-Davis paraphrased the definition of collateral sources. The original definition under Proctor was that a collateral source is a source wholly unrelated to the tortfeasor. Bass-Davis paraphrased that a little bit and said a collateral source is a source other than the tortfeasor. What you would think would be a subtle difference, but turned out to be an important difference here. Now, there's nothing in Bass-Davis indicating that that court intended to make an actual change in the definition of a collateral source. But the court did use some slightly different language.
Yeah, Mr. Eisenberg, remembering Bass-Davis, as I recall, I think I wrote that, and I think what happened was there was an issue of outstanding wage loss, and then the witness was on the stand, and she testified about certain wage losses, but then she was asked about, isn't it true you got these additional payments or additional wages that weren't in the accounting? And we said that violated the collateral source rule, you know, to bring that up before the jury on that issue. So you're saying the facts of this case are different. It's whether the liability or client's carrier is in unison with your client, and it's...
Well, not only are the facts different, but what I'm trying to point out is that when you wrote Bass-Davis, you paraphrased Proctor and you used a slightly different definition.
Right.
The district judge here seized on that. And what the district judge said is, this court maintains a strict reading of Proctor and Bass-Davis. The collateral source rule precludes evidence of compensation for injuries from a source other than the tortfeasor. Here, the defendant's insurance company, Farmers, is a source other than the tortfeasor. So that narrow reading is not what the collateral source rule is. A collateral source is a source wholly unrelated to the tortfeasor. And every court that's addressed this issue has said that if the defendant had paid the bill, that payment would not be within the collateral source rule. The fact that the defendant's insurance company paid the bill makes no difference.
And in fact, excuse me.
Yeah, just one question. I think I understand your argument. It's a pretty straightforward legal argument. My concern is this: is like here the special med specials were at $60,000 or something like that. The total amount that the respondent was billed. That evidence was submitted to the jury. The total amount of those med specials. You're not saying that that amount should be reduced if there was some other payment. If that was the amount billed, it's okay to for the plaintiff in this case to present that evidence to the jury.
Well,
correct? Am I wrong or not on that?
Well, partially.
Okay.
It came up in two steps. There was a motion before trial to exclude any evidence of the $60,000 hospital bill that had been paid. That motion was denied.
Mm-hmm.
And then, after trial, the defense moved for a credit, which is what defense counsel had suggested
right.
in the first place. Let the jury know about the $60,000 bill so the jury isn't misled about the seriousness of the injury.
You're okay with that, though?
But then give a credit later.
So that's fine. I just wanted, what are you asking us to do here? Are you okay with the jury hearing about the $60,000, you know, the amount billed?
With the jury hearing about it, I'm not contending that that was there.
Okay.
Originally, that was the defense position, but then, when the judge denied that, the post-trial motion was also denied, and I'm contending that the court should have given credit for the $60,000 hospital bill that was extinguished.
I want to just clarify the concession point, and it's on the point. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but for purposes of this appeal, your argument focuses on purely the credit against the jury's verdict for special medical damages. And your position, as I understand it, is you're not seeking a new trial because of the failure to introduce evidence of the insurance company's payment, nor are you contesting the admissibility of the medical bill. Your focus is on subtracting from the jury's verdict the amount attributable to the extinguishment of the lien by the pretrial settlement. And further, you're conceding in footnote 3 of one of your briefs that the reduction you seek is $47,140.03, not the entire $60,000 that was the renowned bill that was extinguished, and you make that concession because it was not apportioned. Is that accurate?
That's correct. I make that concession. We're still arguing that we should get $60,000. But because the jury didn't award all of the medical specials, we realize that there's some ambiguity there regarding how much of that was the hospital bill. So for purposes of this appeal, and not to have to go through a whole new trial on damages, yes, we're willing to...
So in terms of the issue before the court, that's what we have today, is whether or not you get a subtraction for $47,000 from the verdict.
Or if you don't believe there should be a subtraction for the $47,000, at the very least, the defense should have gotten credit for the $27,000 that they actually paid out of their own pocket.
That was my question. The arithmetic was the $60,000 bill was settled for $27,000. So your argument is the real meds that the plaintiff or the respondent here incurred were 27, were the difference, 60 minus 27 or 33, except you want to further subtract it based upon whatever the jury subtracted from the $60,000 request.
Not really. The total medical bills were about $77,000. Okay. Of that, 17 was other than the hospital.
Right.
$60,000 was the renowned hospital.
Okay.
Farmers paid $27,000 to Renown. Renown didn't just reduce their bill, they extinguished it.
Right.
And extinguished their lien that went along with it. So a $60,000 benefit to the plaintiff that Farmers paid $27,000 for.
Right.
It really was, in many ways, a win-win-win situation. The hospital got $27,000 that they may not have ever gotten without compromising their bill. The plaintiff got a $60,000 benefit, and Farmers, by being able to negotiate, only had to pay $27,000 to eliminate a $60,000 bill.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody really won by that.
Right.
The district judge's confusion, I believe, if you look at his order, he got confused between the concept of a lien and a write-down for lien and hospital write-downs, which often happen with health insurance companies. The plaintiffs own insurance. They have a deal with the hospital. They write down liens. He got confused between that and the extinguishing of a hospital bill or hospital lien, which is what happened here. Mm-hmm. Farmers didn't buy the lien.
Right.
Once Farmers paid it off, the plaintiff didn't owe a dime to anybody on that hospital lien.
Okay. So I think I understand now. Okay. Thank you.
But tell me why you should get the benefit of an offset for, and we'll call it the full amount of the lien, understanding that you're calling it 47 because of the apportionment issue.
Well, for one thing, I think the public policy should encourage that, because public policy should encourage insurance companies, defendants' insurance companies, to pay the plaintiff's medical bills. And if it's just a dollar-for-dollar credit, there would be less of an incentive to do that. Like in this case, if farmers had to pay $60,000 for that hospital bill, there'd be much less of an incentive to do that. And it also goes back to some extent to what I said before, that win-win-win situation where everybody wins in this situation. But if farmers only gets credit here for the 27 it paid, it's going to have less of an incentive to do that and may not do it again in the future. But at the very least, they should get the 27. And even the district judge recognized that at the hearing, that even if you don't get the 60, are you asking for the 27 back? And they said yes, but then the judge didn't even give that.
Yeah.
I have a question for Mr. Eisenberg, if I may. In order to resolve this case, is it necessary for this panel to clarify what the collateral source rule is in Nevada? You point out the language differences. Some have characterized it as minor, others might characterize it as material between Proctor and Bass Davis. I note that Winchell versus Schiff seems to have used both, the language from both cases. Corey versus Seastrand in the Tri-City equipment case that I authored used Proctor. It seems as though, at least among those five cases, we have some language difference here that, depending upon one's point of view, is either minor or potentially material. It seems as though it was material to the district court in making the decisions in this case.
Well, I agree. Clarification would be helpful to the bench and bar. And Justice Gibbons, in your concurring opinion in the Tri-Counties case, you actually used both. And you cited to Proctor and you cited to Bass Davis. So the opinions are somewhat unclear. Here we had a good district judge who relied on language, in my view, from the wrong case and applied it strictly, as he said. And strictly applying it, he was probably right, but what he strictly applied wasn't right.
So this leads me to a second question that is of concern to me. Which language, if you accept the proposition that it's a material difference, is correct?
The correct language was Proctor. And that's the language that's in the restatement. That's the language that you see in state and federal cases all across the country. And that is that a collateral source is a source wholly unrelated to the tortfeasor or wholly unrelated to the defendant. And that's the language you see consistently around the country. Bass Davis said a source other than the tortfeasor, paraphrasing it, but not intending to change it. And my suggestion would be the original definition.
And then the last question I had on this issue is that the set-off that you've been discussing with my colleagues, whether it's 27 or whether it's 40 and some change, seems to revolve around how this court views write-offs. It seems to me that this was touched on a little bit in the Tri-County case. But I think we would be establishing a rule or precedent in resolving this issue in addressing how the court should view write-offs. What's your view on that point?
Well, I have a view on that, but I would suggest to you that this case does not involve a write-off. This case is direct negotiations between a liability insurance company and a hospital. The hospital reduced its bill, and it was paid off.
Why isn't that a write-off?
Well, it's a write-off in the sense that the hospital gave up its right to collect everything above $27,000. But mm-hmm. in doing that, the hospital didn't assign its lien to farmers so that the plaintiff would still have to be liable for something. The whole bill was written off. And the cases that talk about write-offs and write-downs is what normally happens are first-party insurance cases, not third-party cases. Like
what would be the policy reason for making a distinction in this case? If the defendant had paid the money directly to the hospital and the hospital had written off the balance, I use that term in an accounting sense, they wrote it off, was no longer going to be pursued for collection, why wouldn't, in that analysis, the benefit inure to the injured party as opposed to the tortfeasor? We usually approach that kind of relief to the benefit of the injured party, don't we?
Well, you do under the collateral source rule, and that's because the collateral source rule focuses on first-party insurance, some benefit that's given to the plaintiff by a source wholly unrelated to the defendant. When you look at it from the defendant's standpoint or its insurance company's standpoint, that's a benefit that...
If the hospital decides to take a walk from what appears to have been almost $40,000 or just under it, why isn't that something that is a benefit that would inure to the tortfeasor? Because apparently there was no challenge here that was a reasonable amount of medical costs, that the plaintiffs incurred.
For whatever reason, Renowned Hospital decided that 27 was enough to satisfy it. Maybe they thought there were liability problems. Maybe they thought there were going to be collectability problems.
But in the absence of a challenge to the reasonable amount of medical costs, which there wasn't here, as I understand it, aren't those an indicator for a trier of fact as to the other areas of damages a plaintiff might suffer or have suffered, present pain and suffering, as an example?
That it can be, and interestingly what happened here is during the trial, defense counsel was going to call a witness from the hospital to testify about what they normally would have accepted on a $60,000 bill. She got sick and ended up in the hospital. I don't know which one, but she couldn't come to trial. At that point, the judge said, I've already decided this issue. We don't need to decide anything about that. I've already made my ruling on the collateral source issue.
You're over time, and I'll give you an additional 2 minutes because of the cross-appeal situation, and I will add 4 minutes to your opposing colleague's time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
The clock should be 4 minutes for them. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Anthony Archer on behalf of plaintiff and cross-appellant Jacob Hunt.
Mr. Archer, can I ask you one question unrelated to the discussion of Mr. Eisenberg? Is there was nothing in this record we could tell that there was any offer of judgment of record or being processed or into the calculus of this award. Is there an offer of judgment issue lying out there, or is it not? At this
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Very well.
Okay, so from Mr. Hunt's position, there are four issues, the first of which is whether the district court erred in admitting the Renown bill into evidence. It appears that that issue has been resolved, as appears to have been conceded, so I will not go to that issue, which takes us next to the second issue, which is the collateral source issue here. And there was a lot of discussion about Proctor and Bass Davis, but what there was not very little discussion until Justice Hardesty brought it up was about the write-downs and what a creditor's partial forgiveness of a write-down. And I think that's the key issue in this case. And that's under the McConnell v. Walmart, and that's a district court case, District of Nevada, 95F.sub2D. And what that court held generally is that a creditor, and I'm quoting, a creditor's partial forgiveness of a tort victim's medical bills via a write-down is properly considered a third-party payment, evidence of which is barred by the collateral source rule. Now, granted, yes, that case involved where a plaintiff's insurance company negotiated with the medical provider. But in the analysis of McConnell, they didn't discuss whether it was the plaintiffs or the defendants. What they focused on was whether it was the creditor's partial forgiveness, and that's exactly what happened here. In this case, Cardon Outreach, which is a business associate of Renown Medical Center, independently, without any involvement of Mr. Hunt, our client, reached out to Farmers Insurance, and they started negotiating this write-down. And for 9 months, we had no involvement. We didn't even have any knowledge that this negotiation was going on. And eventually, they reached an agreement to write the bill down from $60,000 to $27,000, $60,000 and change, approximately a 55% reduction. And only after they reached that agreement, then they came to us to discuss it. And I'll get to that a little bit more with regards to the policy discussion. But the key point from the McConnell case is that it was the creditor's forgiveness. It was not the plaintiff's company. It didn't matter under their analysis whether it was the plaintiff's insurance company negotiating or the defense company negotiating. So I think that's critical for this.
So you would rather have no settlement between a defendant's insurance company and a hospital that's leaned any potential recovery? Because you're eliminating the incentive to negotiate and relieve the plaintiff of a potentially devastating hospital lien against the plaintiff and the plaintiff's recovery. I mean, if the hospital, let's say it was a huge lien, $1 million worth of medical care, and the defense insurance company is able to negotiate removal of that lien by paying, say, $100,000 on the $1 million lien, and that removes it from the plaintiff's house and family and car and everything else, the fact that the plaintiff is suing for a recovery, that's still advantageous to the plaintiff to have that lien extinguished in full, right?
Yes. However, there's a big sort of but that goes with that, and that goes to the policy discussion. And that's where we need, in our opinion, we need some framework and some direction, some precedent from this court as to how that can take place and under what circumstances.
Well, what's your suggestion?
So my suggestion, and first I'd like to just briefly address what happened here. So I brought you through to the, so we had the negotiation, the nine-month negotiation between the other parties without the involvement of plaintiff. Then there was a phone conversation between trial counsel that there was this would be satisfied, but only on with the understanding that it would be considered a collateral source. Then there was a confirming letter sent from our office that actually said we agree to this, but, and that's it. I think it's the fourth joint appendix at page 667. There's a confirming letter, and it specifically says this will be considered evidence of collateral source, can't be brought into trial. And then at the bottom, it says, please do not hesitate to contact us if there's any questions, if I've misstated our agreement incorrectly, et cetera, et cetera. Please let us know. We don't hear anything for 5 months, nothing from defense counsel regarding this agreement that this would be considered collateral source.
I'm a little bit perplexed by the reference to an agreement because your client's letter to Padilla seems to just make a unilateral statement that any evidence of this satisfaction is inadmissible under Nevada's collateral source rule. That's an assertion by a lawyer in a dialogue, but is there an accession to that in the form of an actual agreement that this would be inadmissible under that would be true? In other words, that this would be treated as a collateral source and all the ramifications, inadmissible at trial, no offset, et cetera.
Your Honor, there is not an agreement, and that's one of the issues here. We were relying on the oral agreement that was between the parties, and we sent a confirming letter. It could have been done differently. Apparently, it should have been done differently.
And they didn't respond and say
they didn't respond. Yeah. And that's the issue here, is they could have responded, and in 5 months they didn't. And the first we heard that they were going to try and bring that evidence in, i.e. that our agreement, the oral agreement, and then the confirming letter would not be followed, was the motion in limine in December of 2015, and their motion in limine number 14 that said two things which are critical to this discussion. They said, you cannot bring in the $60,000 medical bill. You can't bring that in. But what you can bring in is this $27,000, you have to bring in this $27,000 write-down. So the realistic, going back to the policy implications, what's really happening here is this is a backdoor scheme to exploit a hole in the law.
For purposes of our vantage point, we don't, in this case, confront the issue of whether or not a plaintiff should be allowed to present evidence of special medical damages and then use the offset mechanism rather than outlawing the evidence. Because that's not in this case. Mr. Eisenberg has conceded that he's not seeking reversal on the failure to either exclude the $60,000 or to admit evidence that it was paid in front of the jury that questions the offset on the verdict, right?
As long as that's conceded, then yes, that the first portion is taken out, but then the other...
Because that's an interesting legal issue. I mean, absolutely. But I don't think it's in this case.
As long as it's conceded, it doesn't appear that the first portion is not. But as to the second part of getting this write-down of the $27,000, that comes back to sort of the policy discussion of where the windfall should go to the victim or the tortfeasor, and specifically in this case, under these facts, should that go to the victim or should it go to Farmers Insurance Company who created this issue?
Or the defendant. I mean, the legal analysis would be the same even if the defendant didn't have insurance and the defendant separately negotiated this. Analytically, it's the same issue.
That's correct. But the end result is that the now insurance companies or the defendant can go around the plaintiff and negotiate with medical providers without the input of the plaintiff, who effectively is the party on the contract, the medical lien, and Jacob Hunt here was the guarantor. So now defendants or insurance companies can go around that and negotiate whatever they want behind closed doors, and then potentially defense can come back to plaintiffs. And it has a chilling effect, potentially, on litigation. If they can say, oh, we negotiated this down, it's only worth X, you probably don't want to go to trial.
But I think that's what I originally thought about this case, so that was the issue. But as long as the judge admits the actual amounts billed of those special medical damages, the $60,000, you can make the argument to the jury of the nexus between those medical bills and the general damages. I mean, the only real prejudice isn't if the judge says, no, I'm not going to do that. I only want the amount that's actually paid, in this case to $27,000, and that's the figure that will be presented to the jury on the Washoe County Med. So since Mr. Eisenberg's conceded it, I think, for this case, I don't know if they're conceding it forever, you know, but we're trying to get a rule announced here on how to deal with it. But how is the prejudice to your client, though? It seems to me like I agree with Justice Pickering. You benefited, because if you'd won a big verdict, you'd have a $60,000 lien from Washoe Med. That would tie up all the proceeds, and you might wind up in an interpleader, and it delays your client getting paid and your firm getting paid for their contingent fees. And also, I think doing away with that $60,000 for 27 seems like a win-win for everybody. It's just a question how we do the accounting at this stage.
And I would agree that that's the key point, is how it's done and what's the framework. What is the understanding and what are the guidelines as right. to what insurance companies can do without being
involved. Well, tell your law firm. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I think it's a good question, but can you maybe give us an accounting on this, how, you know, they've requested this offset, and Mr. Eisenberg set forth his calculations. How would you deal with it? How would you deal with this difference of $33,000 between just those specials from Washoe Med? What rules should we announce on that or not announce?
Well, I think in this case, it's convoluted, to say the least,
yes.
because of what happened in the rest of the trial and dealing with plaintiffs' additional issues on the misconduct and the what we perceive as a lower damage award. So in our opinion, in this case, there shouldn't be any offset. Jacob's medical bills totaled $77,000. The jury only awarded $76,000.
No, $64,000.
That was the medical bill.
Right.
But the...
76 total, because there's only 10. I see what you're saying.
It was 10,000 for pain and suffering, 2,000 for...
But what was the total meds that were put in?
I believe it was 76,500 less 12,000, so 64,000. And that's where we get into the discussion of whether, you know, how much the bill composes of that, in which we argue you can't tell, it's conceivable.
So this $33,000 difference between the 60 and the 27, how does that factor, and how would you deal with it.
So, again, and that goes to the unique circumstances in this case, is that there shouldn't be, in our opinion, any offset because of the misconduct that took place and what we perceive as an already low damage award, and which is why we're seeking either a new trial or an additor to what is already a low damage award. And that had to deal with the arrest record and explicitly violating not one but two different orders in limine. So in this case, it's difficult to address that. If it were clean and those issues weren't involved, I suppose we could come up with a better framework as to how that should be discounted. But in light of the additional conduct that took place, on behalf of our client, I can't say that, oh, this amount should be offset, because we don't believe that.
Well, we're just interested because we don't know in this case if we're going to announce a rule as a segue to Bass Davis and Proctor and all those to deal with this situation. I think you're telling us don't do it in this case because it's got some other factors in it. But
so you're sort of urging that an additor, that if we were to incline to order an offset, you would urge an additor because of the misconduct and the low damages that would wash out any offset in any event.
That's correct.
Is that right? Yeah.
That's exactly right.
And can you tell me about the misconduct? It was asking the police officer about the arrest record for your client, and then the police officer blurts out that it was for solicitation, that he had a criminal record.
Correct, yeah. And so what happened, to give a little context, as the court has probably seen in the pleadings, is that our client is, I'll say, not the most upstanding of citizens. He's homeless. He has some interesting beliefs. He doesn't hold a steady job. And so defense counsel knew that. They knew that this was going to be a close call. And so all it was going to take was that little, the straw, the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. And that soliciting that information about his criminal record was that straw. If you have a gentleman who's already down on his luck, who, by the way, the arrest, and that was the whole point, the arrest record had nothing to do with this case. Mr. Hunt was riding his bicycle. Defendant was found negligent per se and 100% liable. So Mr. Hunt, didn't do anything, had nothing to do with an arrest record. Yet defendant, deliberately had the officer have the arrest report. The officer said what it was, and then trial counsel proceeded to ask a question about it.
And then order in limine on that, correct?
Exactly, yeah. And because it wasn't relevant. And so in this case, where it's such a close call, this is, for better or worse, this was not a college student with everything going for him. This is a gentleman who's had some tough times, and so all they needed was that little something, that arrest record, hearing that criminal conduct or criminal activity, whatever it was, a police officer on the stand with an arrest report, that's enough to tip the scales, and we believe that's what it did, and so that's why we asked for the motion, made a motion for a new trial, or in the alternative, an additor.
But you did not, at the moment this occurred, move for a mistrial, correct?
That's correct, and that's an interesting point raised by Mr. Eisenberg, is that we didn't move for that, but keeping in mind the context of the moment, we had just gone through and watched the court effectively reprimand opposing counsel for asking about this arrest record. Let's say tensions were high, and then the court turns to us and say, what do you want to do short of a mistrial? So it's a little hard for us to then ask for a mistrial in the heat of the moment after we've seen the reprimand and then he tells us we can't.
I understand that. It would be a cleaner record if it...
But it was objected to misconduct.
Yeah, it was.
Yes, yes. And that's going to the court's analysis, I believe, under Leche, I'm not exactly sure how you say it, B. Cohen. And so then the argument is that it was enough to warrant a new trial. And the trial court found that it was misconduct, but not enough to warrant a new trial. And we're arguing that it was. In this case, under these special circumstances, with this plaintiff, with this fact pattern, et cetera. Or in the alternative, there should be an additor on the $76,000 because the damage award was inadequate. And that is a result.
Is that a factor we can consider, that the inadequacy in the jury's award may have been influenced by objected to misconduct? Is that legally something we can look at?
I believe so. That's not the, those are not discussed in the Drummond and Lee v. Ball cases, but it would seem to me that an inadequacy of damages award certainly flows from the misconduct. And actually, no, I take that back. I do believe you absolutely can consider it because the two factors are an additor may be granted, and this is under Drummond v. Midwest Growers, 91 Nevada 698, when, one, damages are clearly inadequate, and two, a case is proper for granting a motion for new trial. And so if we're arguing that there was misconduct, there should be the ability to argue that in the additor about the arrest record. So we would pose that it is. And in this case, where Mr. Hunt, I'll back up to Drummond, there was the, in that case, a gentleman had a severed arm and was permanently injured. That was the key language used in Drummond. He was permanently injured, and so he received an additor after the trial. And the key point here with Mr. Hunt is that he's a laborer. He makes his living by doing odd jobs, working at bars, doing whatever he can for shelter, food, money. He rides his bicycle to get around. He needs his back. He suffered a severe injury, and defense, their own expert testified, he can no longer lift more than 50 pounds for the rest of his life. So it's a little hard for a laborer to do his job if he can't lift more than 50 pounds for the rest of his life, and therefore we argue it's a permanent injury, and therefore under Drummond, he should be entitled to an additor.
Someone who wants to live on the street, I mean, that may influence, his choice of living on the street may be influenced by his medical condition as well.
Absolutely. And then finally, the fourth and final issue is that plaintiff believes that the district court erred by denying a jury instruction regarding punitive damages. And this is under the Crawford v. State, 121 Nevada 746, and Wyeth v. Rowett, 126 Nevada 446. And punitive damages can be recovered when evidence demonstrates, quote, despicable conduct which is engaged in with a conscious disregard of the rights or safety of others. And that's the language out of NRS 42.001, subsection 3. An issue here is that the appellant, at the time of the accident, was on five different medications, all of which warned against that they may cause dizziness, blurred vision, lightheadedness, or fainting. Two, that alcohol may increase those effects. And three, one should not drive or operate machinery. Now, there was testimony from the defense that Mr. Padilla had been taking these medications for years. There was no effect. But there was no testimony at any point that he was taking the medications, had drinks, and drove. There was no testimony that those didn't have an effect. The only case we have of that is this case, where he did all three of those things, and it resulted in our client with a broken back in the hospital.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Mr. Eisenberg, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. And I really do need to address McConnell and the alleged agreement. McConnell is the federal case on which the district court relied on, which counsel is relying on here. McConnell was a first-party insurance case where the insurance was purchased by the plaintiff. There's a footnote in McConnell where the court distinguishes between first-party insurance and liability insurance. And what that footnote says is that payment of a tort victim's bills by the tortfeasor's insurance company is legally equivalent to payment by the tortfeasor himself. It is not a payment within the collateral source rule. That's why McConnell is not applicable. This alleged agreement, I thoroughly addressed it in our briefs, and I just, there's not enough time here. There's about six reasons why there was no agreement. But at the end of the day here, it's not proper for this court to make a factual determination that there was some kind of an agreement within the collateral source rule when the district judge never made that determination. And an agreement by farmers that this was a collateral source rule would have been absolutely absurd. It would have been ridiculous. The insurance company would have been saying to plaintiff's counsel, we'll pay $27,000 to this hospital, but we're not going to get any credit for it. No insurance company or defense counsel in their right minds would enter into that kind of an agreement. Justice Pickering, you asked.
I have a question quickly. The lien, did the plaintiff's counsel have a lien on this recovery such that this was negotiated to release the hospital's lien? Was that why there was this dialogue?
Well,
or do you know if it's outside the record, just say so.
I'm not sure. I think there was some discussion, but the case law, as we cited in the brief, is that you don't need an agreement. The defendant and the defendant's insurance company can pay it if they want without an agreement.
Okay.
If I could just have maybe 20 seconds to address the punitive damages issue. That issue is thoroughly addressed in the brief. The judge is the gatekeeper on the punitive damages issue. The defendant's doctor testified that the combination of the medications he takes and the drinks that he had that night was not a combination that would have had an improper effect on him. So there was medical testimony, despite what counsel said here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This case will stand submitted and will be at ease while the parties for the next case come forward.